This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good afternoon. This is Live and Learn on The Bigger Picture, and I'm Sumitra Selvaraj. We often think about play and playing being pastimes that kids indulge in. In fact, according to the United Nations, play and recreation are one of the many rights of children that must be upheld. Let me just say that again. Play is a right of a child. Why is so much importance placed on childhood play? We're about to find out from pediatric neuropsychologist, Dr. Daniel Legoff, who joins me in the studio today. Welcome to BFM, Daniel.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
So we know that playing makes kids happy. It's kind of clear from the way their faces light up. But do we know why it makes them happy?
That's an interesting question. Happy is a positive emotional state associated with having fun. Fun or happy in that context is really a way for our brains to tell us to do that some more or do that again. If you do something over and over and it's fun, typically it becomes less fun. You know, for children and for adults as well, if you do something the same way over and over, it becomes boring. And that fun response doesn't necessarily kick in each time. So what we instinctively do as a result is to change what we're doing slightly or dramatically. But most of the time what we do is we just alter it a little bit, make it a little more challenging, bring in different elements, become creative with what we're practicing at. And as a result, it stays fun. So the natural process for children exploring their worlds is to engage with the things they find around them. And obviously there's huge variability in that with regard to different cultures, historical contexts. Children have different things to play with, from, you know, sticks they find on the ground to, you know, game systems and computers. But the main way that children organize themselves to interact with the world is by watching and then imitating what they see the adults doing, and doing it in ways that are, to them, make them happy or they experience fun doing it. And in the process, that's how they learn.
Okay. So do children need to be taught how to play, or do you think it's a natural instinct?
It really depends on the kid and the context. Most of the time, no. I think play is a natural human tendency and a very important one if you look at the history of it, including evolutionary history. Play has been a critical part of the advancement of culture. If you think about human evolutionary survival, we don't survive because we're great animals. We're actually very poor animals. We have soft skin and blunt little teeth. Our jaws don't open very wide. We're not particularly fast. We have pretty good visual systems, and our hearing's fairly acute. But compared to most of our animal neighbors, we're actually pretty sad as an animal. But what we are good at is culture. So we develop social relationships and technology as a way to make up for our weaknesses as a creature. But you can't be born with culture. You have to acquire it, and acquire it rapidly. And unfortunately, for most of our early life, we're very dependent on adults. Unlike most other species, we don't hit the ground running. In fact, it's quite a while before we can even get up and toddle around. So humans are a very vulnerable, dependent sort of creature for a long time. But our brains are not. So our physical limitations are fairly obvious when you look at infants. What we don't see so easily is how much they're learning and how quickly they're orienting towards things immediately from birth. We see infants looking at faces and processing facial information so that they understand emotions, intentionality, interest. They even notice when their parents move their eyes from early on in childhood, weeks of age. Children notice what their parents are looking at, and they can track their parents' gaze to say, oh, what you're looking at is something important. Fairly soon after that, we start noticing what our parents are touching or playing with, and we look and see how they're manipulating things. Mm-hmm. So we're encoding motor mechanisms in our brains to try later to imitate what's going on in our adult world. And then when children begin to be able to explore the world on their own feet or crawling around, the first thing they do is put things in their mouth. But eventually they start manipulating things with their hands once they have the motor capability. So children explore and pick up objects and try to use them in ways that they see adults doing it. So there's capacity for observation, imitation, and then innovation really is at the core of what we describe as play.
Okay. Are there different types of play, different categories of play, perhaps?
Well, when we do scientific research on play, we divide it up into categories. Typically, there's child-led play, adult-led play, social play, motor play. You know, some types of play are more passive and receptive. You know, if a child is sitting there, you know, using a laptop or a you know, other kind of electronic media, they're receiving more information than they're putting out. In other contexts, certainly with sports, when you play a game or you create something, whether it's a handicraft or, you know, some kind of art form, there's more of an output than an input at that time. But children, it's usually a balance of taking information in, you know, associating it with other cognitive elements, you know, that are acquired through learning, and then an expressiveness. So there's a combination of curiosity as information comes in. You need that to maintain a sense of interest in your environment. And then there's a sense of mastery when you express some kind of individual achievement. Mm. So, you know, you learn by watching and hearing and focusing on what the adults are doing, and then you express some level of personal achievement or mastery by innovating on that and saying, look, oh, I saw you do that, and I can do this too. And then and then eventually you say, I can do this better. You know, I think the greatest achievement of my children's lives was when they could surpass me at just about everything that I could do, you know, when they were better at things than me, stronger than me, faster than me, more capable than I was. And now they're young adults and they're better at me than just about everything.
So in the course of your work, when you observe a child at play, what are you looking for?
When I watch children play, and I watch kids play a lot, it used to be a lot easier. It's become culturally difficult to let a grown man wander onto a playground and observe children. People get very suspicious.
I can imagine.
They don't like to see me sitting out there on the playground taking notes. But I have done that a lot, and it's really interesting. I guess the different ways that I observe children play is when they are learning. Mm-hmm. And it's important to me to see how they imitate and then practice and then innovate on themes of adult culture that include communication. So they practice and play at language, using words in an innovative or playful way. Even small children take words they hear and make little sounds or songs, or, you know, they goof around. They're playful. They get silly with language, and they play around with language, and they do that with each other. And in that context, they're doing social play. So they watch adults interacting both directly and then in the media, and they play at adult-like social relationships. So cops and robbers, and mom and child, and daddy and mommy, and so family relationships, business relationships, you know, work settings. You know, they play at being a pet owner. There's all kinds of social roles. And they, in some instances, are the active adult participant. And sometimes they want to be the child, and sometimes they want to be the dominant one. Sometimes they're, you know, a worker or a colleague, or, you know, so they play out social relationships. The other part that they play at is technology, and that varies a lot by culture. You know, so there might be some, you know, less complex cultures out there where people are still learning to hunt and learning to gather, you know, and they play at the kinds of things that help them get good at just finding food in a jungle somewhere, you know. Or there are very advanced cultures where the children are playing at Like, you know, I would say in my family, every kid had to have either a phone or a toy that was a lot like a phone.
Right. To be able to push buttons.
Yes, or a laptop or some, you know, because they see that's what adults have. They have technology. I want that technology, whatever that technology is, and they want to play with it. So if you look at what children are doing, they're playing with the core elements of adult culture. The creativity aspects of it, whether it's art or craftsmanship, as well as the work, the social relationships, and the technology.
Mm. I want to get into this idea of technology and play in a little bit, but we're going to take a short break. I'm speaking to Dr. Daniel Legoff, a pediatric neuropsychologist who studies and believes in the power of play. This is Live and Learn on the Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9. Welcome back. This is Live and Learn on the Bigger Picture, and I'm Smitra Salvaraj. I'm speaking to pediatric neuropsychologist Dr. Daniel Legoff, who was explaining before the break why children love to play. Dr. Dan, we can't ignore the fact that children these days play very differently from children of years gone by. Today, a child is more likely to play on a screen rather than physically. In your view, does this also count as play?
Absolutely. But as you said, it is different. In some ways, it's not different in the sense that they are focused on the task of acquiring the culture. So there's technological aspects of interfacing with software and software control systems that are going to be part of their adult work world and their success as adults. So somewhat dependent on them being able to pick up and understand electronic media. It is somewhat different, though, that the quality of play that is creative and the quality of play that is social are minimized. Some children play media games that involve other children directly, so you're sitting in the room next to each other, but it is more of a parallel process. You're not interacting directly. You're interacting through the game. The creative aspect of the game is somewhat minimal in the sense that the people who design the game create the levels and decide what will be the next step in terms of innovation or, you know, difference. There's some individual expressiveness about it. I'm just old enough not to have grown up with computer games. And when I was a kid, we had, you know, three channels on television that was black and white, and one of those channels was French. So we had the choice of watching hockey or puppet theaters, and, you know, so we decided to go play outside. Growing up, I didn't have the games, but I got, you know, my kids are well indoctrinated into electronic media, and obviously the kids I work with professionally have access to a lot of, you know, electronic games. But I think it does limit the creative element quite a bit. Obviously some other children will admire how someone is able to be creative with a type of game. There's certain games that allow more for creativity and innovation and individual expression. And it's interesting how valuable that is to the kids. You see how much more excited they are when they see someone do something different or that they hadn't thought of. And it isn't just part of the game. It isn't just unlocking a new level. And it isn't just discovering some key or some button or some, you know, part of the game that was designed for you to find it and that unlocks another level. And then you have another, more varied range of options or something, you know. In typical play, you create those levels for yourself by choosing the materials that you're going to interact with and you decide, you know, how to play the game. So, say you're playing a sport, like you're shooting hoops, you're playing basketball, and someone comes up with a new way to get the basketball into the hoop, or they do something innovative, or they watch some professional basketball player do something and they try to do it themselves. And obviously they may not be able to do it the same way they can. They're not 7 feet tall. So they have to find a way to innovate and be creative. And you see other children really admire that. And the feedback that the child gets when they do something innovative. There was a kid who played soccer or football with one of my sons, and he had this innovative way of throwing the ball in from the sideline. He did a flip in the air when he threw the ball in. He was a very agile gymnastic kid, and he actually did a complete flip and threw the ball very far.
Wow.
As a result of being able to do a flip. He was a hero, you know. His social life was made, you know, because he could score a goal from the sideline. Like, he could, you know, score a goal from a throw-in.
Right.
And so being able to do something innovative like that, or, you know, at a very highly skilled level, regardless of whether it's, you know, with a game, like a computer game or a video console game, or it's on the field somewhere, children recognize that. And I think there's a lot of internal motivation to get that recognition, to be seen as being creative and innovative. And that's really at the core of what drives a lot of what we call play, is to be, you know, to show that you're, to that you can individualize what's happening, put your stamp on it, put your personal mark on what you're doing.
Mm. Here in Malaysia, I think we have acknowledged a growing problem of children below the age of 12, particularly, who are increasingly, I hesitate to use the word addicted, but addicted to the idea of playing with screens on technology. And there is a kind of move away from the traditional type of play of being outside. Do you think it potentially could be harmful if children are less interested in physical play and only more interested in on-screen play?
Unfortunately, yes, I think it can be for a couple of reasons. The primary one is just physical health. You know, children who spend a lot of time, you know, participating in electronic media are obviously not moving around very much. And so so in the United States, we have a critical problem with childhood obesity.
Mm-hmm. Here too.
And they're not as physically healthy, which is a factor, and it limits quality of life and even longevity. So I think for people to be healthy and adaptable, we need to consider physical health and get them active. You know, the fact that we're allowing children to spend a lot of time interacting with media isn't necessarily a bad thing, but it's not a bad idea to try to balance it and to have children experience fun in the context of physical activities as well. The problem is that it's somewhat physically harder. It certainly takes a lot more effort and blood, sweat, and tears, if you will, because there is, I mean, I was a very active kid, involved in a lot of sports, and in fact, you know, most of my childhood was spent on a hockey rink. So, you know, there's a certain amount of physical energy as well as pain associated with sports. You have to be able to push through oxygen debt and you know, and a bruising crunch into the boards, or you know, taking slap shots to the shins. And you have to be really motivated and interested to do that. Part of that really has to do with the neurobiology of fun. And what you were saying about addiction really speaks to that, which is that there's a dopaminergic pathways in the brain. When you say it's someone's addicted to something, it isn't just the substance. It's the way our brains respond to those substances. So when someone becomes addicted to an opiate, for instance, it's not the opiate necessarily just itself, but it's how our brains react to that, which is by you know, flooding the pleasure centers of the brain with dopamine. And the same thing happens with people that participate in sports or other kinds of physical play and other kinds of recreational activities, and certainly, you know, with games. So kids learn that it's probably easier, less effort, and certainly less physical pain to get a dopaminergic rush from playing a video game where the physical effort is electronic. You know, you're moving your thumbs. Your character, the person you're role-playing on the screen, is doing all kinds of leaping and bounding and acrobatic executions. Mm. So you can play World Cup soccer without, you know, any physical effort.
Right.
But that's not a realistic feedback for children. I think kids have to learn that in order, you know, for mastery to occur, it does require a lot of effort. And I think it's one of the difficulties with electronic media is it's almost too easy to be fun, because the engineers who design these games make it as easy as possible for them to experience that level of fun. And so it's sort of a cheap fix.
Yeah. But then it almost feels like, so if you need that rush, if you need that dopamine kind of spike, and you're getting it so easily from a screen, would you then, as a child, look for it away from the screen as well? As in, would the mundane then, or the routine then, bore you more quickly?
Well, a lot of that has to do with his concept of self-efficacy. And self-efficacy is not the same thing as self-esteem, but it's how children think about whether they're good at something or not. And some of that comes from adult feedback. So if people tell you you're good at something, you tend to believe them. But you're also looking at the product, the outcome, and you're comparing socially. So if your parents tell you you're good at football and you haven't scored a goal and you see there's other people on your team that have scored goals, you're a little skeptical. I mean, it depends on the position you're playing on the field and all, you know, things like that. I mean, if you're playing goalie, you don't expect to score goals. But if your teammates tell you you're good, that's a little different. And if you're, you know, you notice that you're able to pass the ball or you're able to trap the ball and you're able to do things that you see other kids doing, and there's you know that you've worked hard at it, and you see the outcome from that, you start enjoying it more because you have a sense of self-efficacy.
Right.
People do things that they're good at. They tend to like to do things that they're good at because it helps us feel better about ourselves. It helps us feel as though other people look up to us or admire us. They give us value. You score a goal on the football field and suddenly you've got a lot of friends. You know, people they smile at you, and there's really something really positive. You know, people are jumping up and hugging you, and you know, and even their parents like you, you know.
Right.
Imagine after the football game, if you scored a critical goal, they take you out for dinner. You're a hero.
Mm.
People really like that, and it's a natural thing to want to be valued by your social environment. It's of evolutionary significance to be valued as a member of your group.
Mm.
And if you're a weak member of the team, you don't want to be in that position. You don't want to be the weakest person on the team, because it means you're less valued by others. The same thing happens in a lot of different settings, obviously from work to neighborhoods. You know, people are like, oh, that guy never cuts his grass, or, you know, that guy's, you know, he parks his car in the wrong place, or, you know, there's just a sense of whether you're valued or not by the people around you, and your family and your culture and your workplace. And we strive to be of value to each other. And you see that very strongly in play. The first thing a kid wants to do when they do something creative is show it off.
So then is it at all possible that a child could be bad at play or bad at playing?
Yes. I mean, yeah, some kids are very bad. I mean, it's one of the reasons I'm so interested in this phenomenon of autism. They don't know how to play. And it really impacts them socially. And I think a lot of people underestimate the extent to which autism really is just a deficit in the ability to play. If you look at what autistic kids are bad at, it's all the stuff that's culturally specific. They're very good at things that have nothing to do with culture, like math or other sort of systematically organized bits of information.
Mm-hmm.
So that, you know, understanding the structure of, you know, animal groupings, like, you know, insects and dinosaurs, or license plate numbers or bus routes. That's sort of a mathematical and systematically structured set of information. It has nothing to do with your social cultural background. When you get into culture, you're talking about things like communication, socialization, and technology that are, you know, relevant to, you know, engaging with other people and being successful, you know, in within a given culture. And that's what autistic people are really bad at.
Mm.
And they don't play. They don't get bored. They do things over and over and over the same way. And they don't seem to mind that there's no creativity involved.
Mm.
So, and I don't want to say that uniformly, like there's no creativity with autistic people. Obviously, a lot of them are extremely creative. But they don't do it in ways that lead them into social relationships. So there isn't that social motivation as part of their play. They're not going to do something creative and then turn around and go, look, Mom. I mean, that's one of the kind of touchstones of what you're looking at when you're trying to diagnose a young child with autism, is whether they initiate joint attention and say, look what I did. You know, typical kids will do that. They'll pick up something and it's interesting to them, and the first thing they want to do is make sure that someone else sees
the validation.
That, oh, this look, this is interesting. And they'll initiate joint attention. They'll have you look at that. They'll catch your eye, and then they'll look down and make sure that you're looking at the same thing they're looking at. Kids with autism don't do that.
Okay. I'm glad you brought this up because, you know, a large part of your work does kind of center around developing play therapy for children on the autism spectrum. Could you perhaps just share with us how you first got into this field?
I was always kind of interested in autism, partly because it runs in my family. It was very interesting to me that I had these very intelligent and creative relatives who behaved very differently and tended to want things to be the same a lot, even to the point of being fairly unreasonable about it. And doing the same things over and over again, where someone else would think, aren't you bored with this already? It's the same stuff, you know. Why would you want things? So this insistence on sameness, this lack of need for variability in your daily activities and in your hobbies and interests, combined with fairly unusual ways of interacting and communicating and sort of unexpected ways of initiating social interaction or seeming very awkward socially. And then when I was early in my career, I guess, I just started private practice, I was very interested and tolerant of people as the, you know, I think right at that time, the interest in autism was just growing. It wasn't as much of a well-known topic as it is today. And the incidence rates, because of the, you know, I think the diagnostic criteria were different and people weren't as focused on it as a developmental issue. It was just sort of starting out. So this is in the mid-1990s. A lot of my colleagues weren't prepared for this type of kid in their practices. They didn't really know what to do with them. And honestly, they probably found them a bit off-putting. A lot of the more significantly autistic kids were difficult to have in your waiting room, difficult to have around you with your other clients. And it was really difficult to know what to do with them because they didn't follow the typical social norms of, you know, coming to see the child psychologist. They didn't, you know, get it. They didn't know what they were. The kid didn't know who you were or why they were there or, you know, what the benefit of coming there was. So they're often kind of oppositional and rigid and difficult to deal with. And a lot of my colleagues said, oh, send him to Dr. Dan. He seems to like these kids. So I got more than my share of referrals of you know, autistic and kids at the time we were calling Asperger's. So, you know, there was a lot of pressure on me at the time to do something meaningful with them. I was like, okay, well, people think I'm good at this. I really should be good at this. And so I was interested in finding something that was effective. And I was reading a lot about therapeutic techniques for this population. And most of the techniques I was working with really weren't that effective. I was kind of disappointed, you know, especially with regard to changes in these kids outside of my office. You know, if I would follow them out, you know, at their school, in their playground, in their community, how were they doing at home, and get feedback from, you know, families and educators about how these kids were doing, not so great. So I was concerned to find strategies that would really help them improve. And the core area of their deficit was the social part.
Okay.
And I think a lot of people get overly focused on the difference is in their behaviors, on some of the rigid behaviors, on the tantrums, the difficulties adapting to environments, their different ways of learning, that kind of thing. I think those are fairly easy things to change, really, compared to changing them socially, to make them more interested. Because what I've seen as kids grow older, and now I have followed many kids for, you know, long enough that they're adults themselves, and I see that if they didn't get enough therapy, they may become reasonably good at a lot of things, but they're still not good with people. And that's very limiting. People have no, I think the average person doesn't really understand how disabling not being social is.
Right.
For human beings, being social is the core of our capacity to have a meaningful life, really. If you're not good with people, it's much more disabling than you think. You know, you have no idea. So, you know, as brilliant and talented as a person can be, if they're not good with people, they're going to have a very limited life. And I really wanted to do something meaningful about that. So I started off with looking at things where I'd be able to capture their interest. And a lot of the kids that I was working with were interested in Lego. And I was like, fine, I'll use that. You know, I didn't see where this was going to go, but eventually it led to more and more kids, you know, wanting to and were motivated to engage with me in that way by interacting using Lego.
So how does it work? How does the play therapy actually work with kids who have autism?
Well, it started out with me, in a way, creating a division of labor in the Lego building process. So I would just have a kid, and I would make them ask me for the pieces. I wouldn't let them have the pieces. And they would say they had the instructions. They would want to build a Lego set. And I intruded myself into the process by holding onto the pieces and only giving them ones when they asked them for them correctly and appropriately. And it evolved from there to a more of a collaborative process where, say, for instance, they wanted to build something they were interested in. It was a freestyle creation. Mm-hmm. And I would get them to describe what they wanted to build. They could just start putting Lego pieces together. They had to tell me or draw or in some way indicate what their project was and then allow me to help them with that project. And because of a number of kids I was working with were doing Lego projects in my playroom, other kids would come in. And for the first time, this was really interesting, for the first time I saw kids looking at something on the wall, because I had, you know, other kids who weren't autistic who were doing creative projects, and they build things out of clay, they might do drawings. I had a puppet theater, and they would leave evidence that other children were there. But the autistic kid would come in the room and act as if no one else ever came there. You know, they were not interested at all that other children came into my playroom. But if they saw a Lego on the shelf, a Lego creation, they would look at it and go, who did that? For the first time, they weren't interested in the drawings. It was almost like they didn't exist.
Why? What do you think it is about those building blocks that...
Because they identified with them. It was an activity that they were interested in. They weren't interested in drawings because they didn't draw. To right. them, drawing was a completely foreign thing. It might as well have been a rock. They have no interest in the rock, unless they were into rocks. But I mean, you know, just to see something on the shelf, they didn't identify it with it. But when they saw Lego, because they're kind of self-absorbed and idiosyncratic in their worldview, they don't have this capacity for, you know, what we call theory of mind, okay. this ability of thinking about how other people think. Mm-hmm. But it sparked an interest in them. It was just a shade of theory of mind. They were like, someone else built that. How interesting. And they ask questions. Who was this? How old were they? How long did it take them to build it? Why did they build that? So they were asking social questions for the first time. And then one day I came out to the waiting room to get a kid, and I was leaving another kid off, and the parents were doing something at the desk, you know. And there were two boys that had both brought Legos from home to show me, Lego creations, and they noticed each other. And one of them later said to me, hey, Dr. Dan, that kid, he's from my planet. And they sort of recognized each other, that they had this, they were both Asperger's. And they it's almost like, you know, twin brothers late in life finding each other and looking in a mirror, or almost like they're looking in a mirror and say, look, I'm like that person.
So and that's not really typical for Asperger's, is it? To make that connection.
Their parents were shocked that the two boys suddenly went off to a space of their own and began talking about Lego.
Wow.
And they talked about Lego, and they talked about Pokemon, and they talked about Star Wars, and they were just like on the same page about their interests, and they recognized something in each other. And so the parents asked if I wouldn't mind doing therapy with the two of them.
Okay.
And that's when I took this division of labor idea to the next level, and I thought, well, how can I do this to keep myself involved? As I predicted that if I had the two of them together with me in the room, they would probably parallel play. You know, each of them would be working on some kind of, you know, either building a set or doing right. some, you know, freestyle creation on their own, and I would just be watching them. You know, that's not therapeutic. So I thought, well, if I can try to get them to do this together in some way and essentially force them to collaborate, you know, make it impossible for them to do solo play, that might create an opportunity for them to see the value of social play.
Right.
And it did. It worked out. So what happened is I divided the Lego building process for, you know, making a set initially, just building a pre-stage Lego set, you know, take it out of the box, and you know, here you put the parts here, and there's the directions. And so I basically broke it down into three interdependent roles. The engineer, who's got the Lego instructions, the builder, who's going to put the pieces together, and then the parts supplier, who's got the Lego pieces, and he gives them to the builder as he needs them, and the engineer tells the part supplier what to give the builder and tells the builder what to do with them. And then at periods of time, I would switch the roles, and I'd say, okay, now you're the you're the builder. You were the part supplier. Now you're the builder, and you were the engineer. You're going to be the part supplier. You know, we would change roles, and they got a sense of what it's like to be in each role, and they collaborate on the project. So then there was a sense of accomplishment, joint accomplishment in the end product, because they're very motivated to get that thing built. And then put it with the rest of their collection that was emerging. You know, I was spending a certain amount of money every week on new Lego sets. But the interesting thing was that other kids would come in the room and start to see this growing collection of Lego sets that was being put up on the shelf. And they wanted to join. They were like, who's doing these Lego sets? And but I was really interested in getting more of the kids who had primarily this social deficit, either because they had social anxiety or they had Asperger's or they were just very, very bright kids. Some of them were like, I had a lot of kids that were just sort of gifted. Mm. And had difficulty socially with peers because they couldn't identify with them very much. They weren't interested in the same things they were interested in. Mm. And they identified better with the sort of socially awkward, you know, socially unsuccessful kids, but that were otherwise very creative and thoughtful.
What you mentioned earlier about switching the roles around in the building process, what an interesting way to teach empathy, to kind of, in role playing, switch the focus so that you understand what it's like to be in somebody else's shoes or role.
Well, yeah, it's very concrete in a sense that you're being confronted with the fact that you have to think about what that person needs in that moment. Mm. And having just sat in that chair,
right,
you understand immediately that in order to be, for instance, the builder, you need to have the pieces lined up for you. And the next piece, so it goes faster. And they're very motivated to get this done. Mm. You might have a very complicated piece and you're rushing to get it done. And so there's this natural pressure created by your motivation for the Lego activity to get better at empathy. Mm. And so the understanding that person's point of view and what it's like to be in their shoes with this task in front of them, how do you think like them better? And the kids will even express that. They'll say, you know, I'm trying to understand him better and the way he thinks so that I can anticipate, or if you're the engineer, how do you communicate best, you know, what the person needs to know in order to make the next step happen?
Right.
And the interesting thing about Lego in this, and people often ask me, why was it Lego, you know, as opposed to some other toy system? And the interesting thing about Lego is that all the pieces, you know, in order to build a Lego set, say it's 120 pieces, that's 120 opportunities for them to have this communication.
Right.
So once I had added more kids, so we got to be 3, and then it was 6 kids in a group. And within a few weeks, this group had grown and grown and grown. And so we had to start more groups. And there was kind of a buzz. People were hearing there was something going on, and I hadn't collected any data yet. I didn't have an outcome study yet, you know, but there was kind of a word of mouth about these kids showing some fairly striking and immediate changes in their social abilities.
So what were the outcomes that you were looking for?
When I first started wanting to establish that there was a, you know, an empirically derived basis for this, you know, what kind of scientific evidence. I was struck with the struggle of how do you measure social competence in children? It seems like it should be easy, but it's not. Mm. And so I came up with some measures. Initially, I had 3, and I wanted to have these measures observable on a playground. So I didn't want to see improvements just in the Lego room, because I was there and I was influencing the children. And then, because the groups had grown, I was running maybe 5 or 6 groups in the week with 6 or 7 kids in each group. And so there were, you know, dozens of kids involved. And I wanted to make sure that what I was doing was effective. It wasn't just fun, you know, it was making a difference. So I had some graduate students agreed to do the observations for me and collect data on these kids before they initiated the group and then after. So we did what's called a timeline design where the children were in a waiting period before they were brought into the group. So we observed them on the playground prior to Lego therapy and then at 3 months and then 6 months after participating. And there were three measures we were looking at. One was the frequency of what we call idiosyncratic behaviors, so flapping your hands, putting your fingers in your mouth, spinning around in circles, talking about insects. We had sort of identified some autistic behaviors. And those were naturally sort of disappearing as kids developed an interest in peers, and they became more self-conscious about exhibiting behaviors that might interrupt their social engagement.
Mm-hmm.
The other variable we looked at was how often these kids initiated social contact with other children. Did they walk up to other kids and initiate some kind of engagement during free time without adult prompting? So there was no adult telling them, go join those kids, but they went up and tried to initiate social contact. That turns out not to be a very good measure, by the way, because kids who are good at social functioning spend most of their time playing with one kid. They don't initiate contact with a bunch of peers.
Mm.
So it's a self-limiting kind of variable. But the third variable turned out to be the most valuable one, and that was the duration of social play. So if you initiate contact with another child, how long does that interaction last on average? And are you able to sustain, you know, longer periods of interaction with a single kid? Because regardless of what's happening in that interaction, whether, you know, it's kind of arbitrary whether, you know, we as adults would define what is happening as appropriate or not. That would be hard to measure whether what was happening was appropriate.
Mm-hmm.
But if it kept on going, it probably was okay. At least the other kid was willing to put up with it and would be able to put up with it on more than one occasion. So what we looked at was the average duration of social interaction over a number of observations. So if you spent more and more of your time interacting with one or two kids on the playground, you were getting better at social functioning.
Got it.
That was our way of defining it. And the striking thing about it was that within 3 months, these kids had more than doubled the average duration of social interaction.
Mm-hmm.
So they may have gone from maybe spending a few seconds, you know, or up to a minute interacting with a kid during play to multiple minutes. And then it just kind of like grew exponentially and then kind of maxed out. They would spend their entire recess with one kid because now they're able to sustain relationships and have friends. And this is within months of starting Lego Club.
Wow. Dr. Dan, thank you so much for sharing your insights with us, especially on the work that you do developing play therapy for children with autism. I've been speaking to pediatric neuropsychologist Dr. Daniel Legouf about the benefits of play and recreation for children. If you missed any part of this interview or any previous Live and Learn segments, you can download the podcasts on our BFM app or on Spotify. You've been listening to Live and Learn on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, The Business Station.